How can business intelligence and data analytics help medical centers in developing countries like Uganda operate more efficiently? That's the topic today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. One of the missions of the Walter Bradley Center is exploring and cultivating ways AI and other advanced technology can be applied in developing countries. Unfortunately, governance in developing countries is sometimes hindered by inefficiencies born of corruption and an uncaring bureaucracy. Dr. Peter Kalaba from Uganda knows about this from firsthand experience. Most Americans know about Uganda from when Idi Amin was president. Idi Amin is best known as the big ego bloviating president of Uganda who sheltered terrorists and their hostages in 1976. The hostages were freed in a daring commando raid by Israel. Forrest Whitaker won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Idi Amin in the 2006 motion picture, The Last King of Scotland. But Idi Amin is long gone. Uganda's governance, though, is still considered by many to be somewhat corrupt and untrustworthy. There are Ugandans, though, that still strive to make their country a better place to live. One is our guest today, Dr. Peter Kalaba. Dr. Kalaba is a physician from Uganda who is looking at business intelligence and data analytics to solve terrible mismanagement of medical facilities and misuse of medical supplies, including medicine. And we're going to be talking to him today about his use of data analytics and business intelligence in solving these problems. Peter, thank you for being a guest here today. I talked to you before, and I learned so many interesting things. You mentioned that in Uganda there is a lot of mismanagement and medical challenges. Could you talk about some of the medical challenges that exist in Uganda today?
First of all, thank you for having me here.
Okay.
Where do you start? I think there are a lot of things that are getting better in Uganda, but we still do have a huge challenge. The primary one of them is that we do have a very high patient to doctor ratio. It's in the thousands, almost. If you count the number of students who've graduated from university, from medical school.
So for every 1,000 citizens, there's one physician, roughly?
Yeah, almost for every 1,000, 2,000, if you count the number of people who've graduated from university.
Oh.
If you count it in real numbers, you probably have 10,000 people for each medical doctor. And if you go to a rural environment, it's probably 30,000. Then you do have a very inefficient drug management system. So every year, almost every quarter, we do have in the newspapers an article, like some I shared with you, where they're throwing away almost a third or a quarter of the drugs that were procured for that season. So if you can imagine almost a quarter to or a fifth of the national budget on healthcare.
A fifth of the national budget on healthcare.
Or of the drugs that have been procured go to waste every year, and that's money that could be used to treat people. You have other inefficiencies in hospitals. So
how is the money wasted? Do they spend it on? Do they buy too many aspirins?
Sometimes it is buying too many aspirins when you need something else. Is one of the sad stories was there was a procurement for cancer drugs, and the cancer institute ordered for 3 drugs, and they bought 2 of the 3. And so you
needed all 3 of the drugs for it to work.
Of course, you need all 3, you know, the combination to make it work. So you can imagine the two types that were bought were useless without the 3. So everything went to waste. And so you had cancer patients not having medication, you know. So there is inefficiencies like that. I mean, the problems are not just limited to the government, though. Is there are problems in the private sector. A lot of them having to do with the fact that sometimes you just get so overwhelmed trying to treat or make a difference or do whatever you're doing or make some money from the process because it's not a very lucrative, it's not as lucrative there as it is here.
Yeah.
And so you have people running these businesses until they run them down, and every fourth or fifth year, they're starting a new medical facility.
Now, why do they run them down? Is it the idea that they're just looking out for themselves as opposed to the patients, or why are they run down?
It's a mix of a lot of things. It's on one hand, you're trying to do something good and survive doing it, and you fail to do that. On the other hand, you just have poor data management, and so you do not really know what you're dealing with, and that feeds into your planning cycle. It feeds into the rest of how you operate and how you run things. I had the experience of having set up a facility, and I remember my experience was working for somebody else and saying, I have to do this and I'm going to do it different, you know? And then I start, and 4 years later, I'm like the person I left, you know?
Oh, is it you become what you don't want to be?
Yes. And I realized, well, you know, I probably judged the guy too hard. It's because here I am, I'm struggling to pay bills. I'm struggling to do this. I'm dealing with an inefficient insurance system where bills get paid 6, 7, 8 months late. Sometimes, the billing system is out of whack. Sometimes you're dealing with a lot of patients who cannot afford their treatment. Very poor loyalty to the process.
And this is when you were working for the government, is that right?
This is when I was working privately.
Privately.
Is my challenge is when I was working for the government, we're in a whole different ballpark.
Oh, gosh. One of the things that we talked about, I think most Americans are chilled about. I remember reading a book, gosh, it was over 15 years ago when I first learned about the Marburg and the Ebola virus.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that this is not necessarily in Uganda, but in West Africa, kind of an annual or a semi-annual occurrence. It's something which breaks out.
In Central Africa, so I know that most Americans, the most recent experience or the biggest picture they have of Ebola is what it did in West Africa recently, because that made global headlines, you know? And it was interesting because sometimes when Americans think about Africa, they think about it as one country.
Yes.
And so it's interesting how far Uganda is from Nigeria. So in Central Africa, where the Democratic Republic of Congo is found and Uganda is probably an annual or a biannual cycle of Ebola or Marburg. So it is more common than most people think. I would give credit to the governments in the region there for that. I think in Central Africa, where people are used to Ebola and Marburg, there is a very rapid emergency response. So I guess that's where you never hear about. Well, it might make some news, but you never hear about it a lot in America or anything like that, because unlike what happened in West Africa, where they just didn't know what they were dealing with, it had to do with people moving up from the Congo into West Africa, and so they introduced something that there was just no knowledge of, is for us, the moment somebody shows up with a weird fever or a hemorrhagic fever, everybody kind of knows what to do.
So therefore, the governments have their ducks in a row as far as dealing with Ebola and Marburg,
right?
Yes,
about a decade ago, we had a very bad episode of Ebola. And I think a lot of people learned a lot of lessons very quickly.
I bet. They learn quickly and die.
And since then, I think there have been 4 or 5 outbreaks. But none of them has ever claimed more than, 20, 30 people? Which is good.
Yeah, that's decent if you're talking about comparative figures, I suppose.
Yes.
I know that you have lived with the consequences of medical inefficiencies and the lack of medical supplies in Uganda.
Yes.
And could you share some of those? Because I think that us sitting here talking about it in the abstract is very much different than you actually living that challenge.
Well, like we discussed before, I think it was in 2001, 2002. Fresh out of medical school, ready to take on the world.
Yes.
Christmas, it was Christmas Eve. Both on Christmas Day and on New Year's Eve, on both days, I happened to be on duty at the emergency unit in pediatrics. And we lost like 22 babies on one of those days and 19 on the other.
22 babies were lost 19.
I shouldn't call them babies, but I mean children below the age of 5.
Yes.
You get? And it's one of those experiences where you're helpless or hopeless. I don't know what. I mean, so we had the blood. I mean, they all needed a transfusion. So we did have the blood to transfuse them. We did not have the kits.
You didn't have the needles.
The needles to get it in. And I hope I don't get arrested for this. I and my colleague on duty on both those nights, because we were both on duty those nights, we whenever we used to be on duty, we used to use part of our salary to try and buy some needles, you know, to help, because there was always somebody who showed up for whom the needles had run out and we needed help and they couldn't buy their own. Or we would go into the other wards in the hospital and go pinch some needles, put them in our...
You would steal.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to use the word steal. But technically, we would steal them. And go and use them, you know, to help. That night, on those two nights, I remember them like yesterday, is we'd used up everything we'd stolen. We didn't have any money to help. And so we had the experience of holding child after child over a 12-hour period and just watching them die. And we just literally watched them die. And so you come off from that, and I guess that tests your resolve on whether you want to stay on and make that difference or just go off and do something else.
It has to take a large personal wage
so
to do that.
I think that drove me away from serving within the government,
because
I just didn't want to deal with that again. I did try privately to continue to practice. I then moved into HIV/AIDS care, which went well for a long time. I mean, we had Senator Brownback come at the beginning of the PEPFAR program, and we launched that, and then we started having issues because they made me have to choose patients.
You had to choose patients. Was this the HIV thing we talked about?
Yes, I had to choose patients.
Tell that story, because I think, along with the loss of the lives of the babies and children, this one is just gut-wrenching.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the PEPFAR program, before that we had an arrangement, a subsidy program from GlaxoSmithKline, where they were subsidizing medication for patients. And then PEPFAR came along, and so we transitioned to PEPFAR. But the clinic were...
You translated to what now?
PEPFAR. It was a presidential initiative on HIV/AIDS care, George W. Bush program for Africa. It was a $5 billion fund or something like that. And so when that started, of course you had fund implementers down in Africa. And so we were running, I think, 3 clinics at that time. And one of them happened to be in the more Beverly Hills kind of neighborhood of Kampala. It's a place called Kololo. And we were running that clinic there not because we were treating the rich people in the neighborhood, but because we'd figured out that we could see a whole lot more patients in there because they could get... There was a lot of stigma in care, and so they could get to the clinic without being noticed. So when the program started, they said, well, your clinic is located in Kololo, so we're not going to include it in the program. And and so then we had the back and forth. And so I stuck my neck out and claimed that, you know, these are our poor patients who need help. As you remove the subsidy from them, they cannot afford the full cost of drugs. It's going to be a problem. So I think as it hit back to me, I was told, okay, fine, go pick 1,000 patients. At that time, I had 4,500 patients.
You had 4,500 patients.
Yes, and so
you gave them all very personal care, right?
Yes, and so I was told to pick 1,000 patients, and you can't pick more than one person from a family. So I had within 3 days, the news had gotten out that I was picking patients.
As my understanding, there was a government edict that with the treatment of HIV, only one person per family could be treated.
It wasn't the government.
Oh, it wasn't the government.
It was a fund implementer issue. So the organization mandated by the U.S. government to help implement in Uganda passed down that edict, and I had the job of picking 1,000 patients out of 4,000. And so then having to sit down with the parents and ask them, you pick one of your children.
This is like a Sophie's Choice, if you're familiar with the movie, where she had to choose which of her children lived and died,
on
the line of a Nazi concentration camp.
Yeah, with the understanding that your bills are about to go up for the rest of your care. You've been paying 50%. It was actually 60% subsidy on the rest of your medication. Suddenly, you're going to pay 100% for the remaining members of your family, and we get to pick one who will get free treatment.
Well, Peter, thank you for that insight. I tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to have you for a second episode so we can continue on this, because we haven't even got to the data analytics and the business intelligence that you're applying. So would you be willing to stay on for a little bit more talk?
Yes, I would.
Okay, excellent. So until next time, for Mind Matters, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.